A county, any county, providing at least 6 months of notice with regard to the redetermination of TEFRA and involving disabled children. And so that's, I think, all the introduction I'm going to give. If Senator Lynch has any other thoughts, if not, Mr. Brad Trahan from Rochester and a good longtime friend and a champion of autism in our community is here to testify.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, and members, this bill is a result of what I think is something being brought forward that we can look to as this is really common sense and is really, while it carries no fiscal implication, I want to really focus on that, no fiscal implication, it will serve to help a tremendous amount of families, and I think Mr. Tran can speak to that.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Tran.
Thank you, Senator Murray, Chair, and I also want to thank the Health and Housing and Family Security Committee as a whole. Thank you very kindly for your review with regard to the above-referenced matter. This matter before you may seem simple and easy. However, it is very important for children and families across the state of Minnesota. This will be a huge victory for Minnesotans faced with this challenge daily. Ironically, this bill is not about spending or asking for any money. Rather, it's simply amendment change to read as follows. And I'm just going to cite the statute, that notice of redetermination, that the county shall provide at least a six-month notice with regard to redetermination of eligibility for a program under this section in order to provide adequate time for families to gather necessary information to determine ongoing eligibility. The state's current system is set up to give parents or legal guardians only 3 months' time to have their child's redetermination process of TEFRA reviewed. However, the problem that exists across the state of Minnesota is that it takes longer than 3 months to get the necessary medical appointments the state requires to review if that individual should continue to receive services. We respect that the state having to review and determine each case. We also respect and appreciate that this review must have the most recent medical documents no later than 3 months back. However, what the six-month notification allows is a family simply time to make the necessary appointments for the state mandates and to meet their deadline date. I came up with this suggestion after we received notice in mid-January 2007 that our son, Reese, who has severe autism and moderate mental retardation, his eligibility was up on March 31st, and we needed everything accomplished by that March 31st date for continued services. It is no longer practical, Chair, to get all the appointments in which the state requires, and I believe we had approximately 5 medical appointments for Reese. This change of language simply is the right thing to do. It helps children's parents, guardians, physicians, and human services, finance, and social workers across the state of Minnesota. Matter of fact, I've had physicians and human services alike already give me their support on this language change. Unfortunately, we have had children eliminated from this program due to missed deadline dates that are difficult to achieve. And some do not realize that their communication with human services would help them. However, they are simply overwhelmed already with the whole process, and giving them 6-month notification rather than the current 3-month notification would help them tremendously. I kindly ask that you support Senate File 2024. Please sign on as Senate authors if you would and or have this bill pass through the Senate. And I would certainly encourage any questions you may have at this time, other than to mention that according to the Department of Minnesota Education, Mr. Phil Sievers, and back in the year 2000, we had identified in the state of Minnesota 2,814 kids in the autism spectrum prevalence disorder. At a 25% rate increase in just 3 years from now, that number is projected to go to 26,207. And those numbers are expected to double in the next 7 years. It's just not giving our doctors and physicians and our psychiatrists and psychologists enough time to see these alarming rates. What this does is our parents can get notification, we can set our appointments within the 3 months that the state requires, and that we meet the deadlines. It's easier on the DHS, it's easier on the Senate, but most of all, it's very important for our children and families.
Thank you, Mr. Tran. How often do they redetermine eligibility?
I believe it's every 2 to 3 years, Chair.
And they choose based on what they feel the need is.
Yeah, what they do is they'll take their assessments from the medical review through the doctors, through the psychologists, through the psychiatrists. That all information is all gathered. You know, it's taking our doctors in addition. It's not only seeing the patients themselves, Chair, but they have to gather all that data and put it in documentation. That's taking our doctors anywhere from an hour to an hour and a half to put together. If you times that on top of all these patients they're seeing, it takes a lot of time. And then they take that information. It's all set up to DHS to see if that individual is redetermined to continue to receive services.
Thank you. Senator Worgen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senderman, Senator Lynch, I don't have any problem with this. My only question is, does the county know at least 6 months in advance?
Mr. Chair and Senator Worgen, the county knows right now the current statutory requirements. And so through this statutory language, the counties would be notified accordingly, would make adjustments in their files.
Further questions, discussion from the committee? Mr. Trahan, I appreciate your presenting to the committee when we were down in Rochester. One question about the incredible growth of autism. Is there any new research that's giving any hints to the reasons for it?
That's the frustrating thing for us parents, Chair. Right now there's no known cause and no known cure. There's a lot of speculation. It's always been my position for doctors, researchers, and parents alike that we must stay open-minded until medical science can tell us with medical certainty. There's a lot of speculation out there, but right now, no, we do not have an absolutely cause. There's all kinds of speculation. I'm not going to take a position other than we do have a growing problem. In response to Senator Worgen's comment, it is my understanding that the state does trigger the system to the counties, and that notification goes to the county. So they would be very much in the loop at that point. And they're just they would have to create the variable change with the DHS to have that variable go from 3 months to 6 months, and then the state would notify the counties.
Further discussion? If not, Senator Lynch moves that SINFOW 2024 be recommended to pass, and I believe that goes straight to the floor. Further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who needed to be heard from on this issue? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Senderman Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Carlson, apparently you are number two. And we're going to take up Senator Latz's bill next, he requested. Welcome to the committee. You have the most interesting bill title tonight.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It is a very interesting bill. We are here, Mr. Chair and committee members, we're here to discuss Senate File 3332, which is a bill that makes a slight correction because of an unintended consequence. It was a bill that mandated the location of transporting a casket or a container with a body in it. And what happened was that this didn't account for the times when you would want to have a ceremonial funeral procession. And I brought with me two members of the Honor Guard of the Minnesota Fallen Firefighters Memorial Association, Mr. David Hammer and Ms. Kathy Osmondson. And Mr. Hammer has a little bit of testimony for you.
Welcome to the
committee. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm David Hammer from Eagan, Minnesota. I'm here to address the amendment in Senate File 3332 dealing with the transportation of dead human bodies. I'm representing the Minnesota Fallen Firefighters Memorial Association, a nonprofit organization formed in the summer of 2001. We are a statewide fire service honor guard, and our goal is to ensure that every line of duty death, or LODD, firefighter is provided with a dignified and honorable service. Our first priority is the wishes of the firefighter's family. Our second priority is the wishes of the fire department. Everyone else comes third. Last year, we learned of the revision of the law that requires the dead body to be inside the same vehicle as the driver of the vehicle. A traditional LODD funeral has a casket being carried on the top of a fire truck. If you go to the funerals of the 343 firefighters who died in the World Trade Center collapse in 2001, you'll see all those caskets placed on top of the fire truck for the firefighter to take his final ride to the cemetery on a fire truck. For every LODD funeral that MFMA has assisted with since 2001, every family has requested their fallen firefighter take the one last ride on a fire truck. The family and the fire department doesn't take that decision lightly, as they usually even request a specific fire truck to be used that was important to the firefighter. I was hoping the daughter of Don Billig, St. Cloud Fire Department, could be here tonight, but she wasn't able to attend. Don Billig was an assistant fire chief who died tragically on October 27, 2003. She passed on to me the following. As a daughter of a fallen firefighter, I cannot express how important the Minnesota Fallen Firefighters Memorial Association is. Back when my father was killed in the line of duty, our lives were turned upside down. This organization came in and made my dad's funeral into a full honors affair. It was brought to our attention that we were able to use the fire truck that was his responsibility of the station to carry him on his last call before being laid to rest. For us, this was a huge honor because firefighting was his life and he died doing what he loved. The fire service was a second family to him. To see his casket on top of the truck was very hard at first, but an honor at the same time. And that is the way he would have wanted it to be brought home to his final resting place. It would have been a very different outcome for all of us had he been brought there in a hearse. It would not have been such an honor. We look at the pictures now, and it brings a smile to me and my family's faces as we remember and reflect on that day. Please take this into consideration when you look at this bill. This is all about the firefighters who lose their lives every day trying to help others. I know my dad was taking his last ride that MIFMA and the department were very careful when securing his coffin on the top of the fire truck, and it was safe up there. That's from Jenny Cater, his daughter. I understand the reason for this law was written last year. For myself, personally, I've done many military funerals in recent years. I've seen items I won't discuss for the privacy of the families, but understand the need for the rules. MIFMA is concerned with the safety and dignity of the line LODD firefighter. Tradition is an LODD funeral as the fire department is pallbearers. We work with the fire department, ensure they have a safe way to get the casket up and down from the fire truck. We help them ensure the casket is secured during transport to the cemetery. MIFMA even has a donated casket that allows the LODD fire department to practice their plan for the day of the funeral. We leave nothing to chance and develop a plan for the fire department to follow. Myself and MIFMA ask that you please pass the amendment contained in SF 3332 so the Minnesota Fire Service can continue to honor line-of-duty death firefighters in this time-honored tradition of providing them one last ride on a fire truck. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you have some comments as well, ma'am?
I'm just here for support. I ditto what David said.
Thank you both. Is there questions from members of the committee? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, is this limited specifically to firefighters, or is this for everyone?
It looks to me like anybody, as long as you convey your preference and it's done in a dignified manner.
So Mr. Chair, this was brought up specifically for line of duty death, but we expanded it just a bit to make sure that it covered anything that the family also preferred and the deceased may have wanted. For instance, there may be sometimes when the deceased wants to be in a particular car or conveyance or something like that and might have it in a will.
Senator Worgen.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to move the bill and recommend it to pass and go to the floor.
I believe it goes to the floor, yes. Senator Worgen moves Senate File 3332 be recommended pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
Senator Letts. That's this A1 amendment you wanted incorporated in the bill for your presentation?
We'd like to have the A1 amendment added.
Senator Torres-Ray moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Go ahead when you're ready, Senator Ratz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. This bill would change a law that currently prohibits massage therapists and other professionals of alternative therapies from having romantic or in particular sexual relations with former clients. Current law requires a 2-year waiting period after they are no longer client before that could occur. This would delete that two-year waiting period and simply prohibit that kind of conduct when there is the client-therapist relationship. This proposal is arising out of a particular case that has received some public attention, and it's also the subject of current constitutional litigation, the argument being that the provision is unconstitutional. But we are here seeking to make the statutory change because I think it's good public policy for the reasons that will be set forth by the person who's with me here to testify, Robin Wolpert from the Green Espo Law Firm, which is also the law firm that is litigating the constitutionality of the statute.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Robin Wolpert, and I am very pleased and honored to be here today to testify in favor of Senate File 3000. Let me begin by explaining my interest in this bill. For the past year or so, I have legally represented a Minnesota massage therapist named Lorae Fellman, who was famously investigated for having sex with her husband, a former client, within 2 years of having provided him with massage therapy services. In the course of that representation, I have had the opportunity to observe the defects of Minnesota Statute 146A.08, and I would like to share my thoughts on this legislation with the committee. Mrs. Fellman is a massage therapist in Lindstrom, Minnesota, a small town of 3,000 people. Beginning in October 2000 and ending in April of 2002, she provided massage therapy services to Kirk Fellman. And during that time, they had no romantic relationship or interest. It was simply a professional relationship. They began dating several months after the professional relationship ended, and then they later got engaged and were married in 2003. Some months later, the Department of Health informed Mrs. Fellman that her relationship with her husband was under investigation, and the department subjected Mrs. Fellman to a tape-recorded interview or interrogation that included pointed questions about her sexual activities with her husband and her sexual relationship with her husband. The department ordered Mrs. Fellman to undergo a psychological exam, and the state-appointed psychologist found that Mrs. Fellman posed no threat to her clients or to the public. But nevertheless, the department instituted disciplinary proceedings against Mrs. Fellman, and Mrs. Fellman ended up running about $10,000 worth of legal bills fighting for her right to get married to a former client and have sex with her own husband. The Fellmans have been publicly humiliated. Mrs. Fellman has lost clients and friends. She had to spend money to establish a new office in Wisconsin and, just in case she lost her right to practice in Wisconsin. And eventually, the Department of Health actually issued an order imposing a fine and ordering her to refrain from having sexual activities with former clients. Now, after Mrs. Fellman notified the department that she was actually seeking judicial review of this decision and this order, the department unilaterally changed its mind, rescinded the fine, rescinded the order. So how did this happen? How did this situation happen? Well, it happened because Minnesota Statute 146A.08, Subdivision 1D, prohibits alternative healthcare providers, including massage therapists, from having a sexual relationship with a former client for a period of 2 years after the professional relationship has ended. Now, as this committee is well aware, the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized the right to privacy, for married couples. Senate File 3000 would eliminate the authority of the department to investigate and punish individuals for exercising their fundamental right to engage in private sexual activities with their husbands or spouses. This bill would not in any way, and I would like to emphasize this, would not in any way undermine the ability of the Department of Health to investigate and discipline therapists who engage in sexual relations with current clients or sexually exploit current clients. That would remain prohibited. If enacted, this bill would bring Minnesota law into line with national ethical standards. It would bring Minnesota law into line with the ethical standards of other states, none of which, by the way, have a waiting period at all for engaging in sexual activities with former clients. And finally, the bill would harmonize Minnesota law internally because Minnesota law regulates whether healthcare providers can engage in sexual activities with former patients. And there are different categories or different standards for psychotherapists, for psychologists, and then for physicians and chiropractors. And what we are proposing is that massage therapists and alternative health care providers belong in the same category as physicians and chiropractors who have no waiting period and no prohibition on engaging in sexual activities with former clients. Let me briefly say that Senate File 3000 also addresses one other issue. Subdivision Q of this statute makes it unlawful to undertake or continue a professional relationship with a client in which the objectivity of the practitioner would be impaired. Now, the statute does not define impaired objectivity, and it's important to remember that the right to practice a profession is a valuable property right which can't be deprived without due process of law. And a law is unconstitutionally vague and denies due process if its prohibitions are not clearly defined and if a person of ordinary intelligence would have to guess at what the statute means. And this is the situation with this law. The ordinary practitioner with common sense wouldn't know what impaired objectivity means. The Department of Health has taken the position that accepting tips, exchanging small gifts with clients, and socializing with clients might constitute impaired objectivity and would subject a massage therapist to disciplinary action. So the statute doesn't say this, and so the reason, so Senate File 3000 proposes that we eliminate the impaired objectivity provision. And why don't I conclude my remarks here and ask if there are any questions? I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions from the committee. Ms. Wolford, with after this bill would pass, the only professions where there'd be a prohibition for a period of time afterwards would be, as you said, counselors dealing with psychology, psychotherapists, psychiatrists, and so on.
Yes.
All of those professions, are they unlimited, or are they 2-year prohibition, or? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. For psychotherapists and social workers, under certain conditions, those healthcare providers can never have or never engage in sexual activities with former patients. So it's a lifetime prohibition. For some practitioners, like psychologists, there is a 2-year waiting period. And then for chiropractors and physicians, there is no prohibition on engaging in activities with former clients, and obviously no waiting period. So what we're proposing is that alternative healthcare providers like massage therapists belong in that third category. They are most akin to physicians. They're most akin to chiropractors. They don't run the risk of transference, that risk that when you have a close relationship with a mental healthcare provider, that risk that you are overly dependent on that healthcare provider and you might be more vulnerable to sexual exploitation. So we believe that massage therapists do not fall in that category and do not run that risk.
It's interesting because, the mental health field would be different, but I was surprised that you said social worker is a lifetime ban, and psychologist, you said, was 2 years?
Psychologist is 2 years, yes.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Senator Worgen.
Mr. Chair, I see where in D it's addressing the 2-year wait, but when the witness was talking about item Q being addressed, I don't see that that's addressed in here at all.
It's in the amendment. She's deleting lines
3.8
through 3.10.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Is there somebody who wanted to testify concerns about the bill? Or Mrs. York? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Senator Marty. My name is Barbara York. I'm the president of the Minnesota Therapeutic Massage Network. I'm also a board member of the Minnesota Natural Health that helped to bring this law into place. When we passed this bill, Representative Carruthers was part of the suggestion that this be part of our bill. And we as practitioners and consumers at that time had plenty of time to object to it. We did not. We saw this as a consumer protection bill in keeping with Statute 214. Unfortunate as this is, that this came to pass, what it came from was basically a malicious event brought about by the ex-wife of the man who married the massage therapist. And so that is part of why the state dropped that bill, dropped that case, was because it never should have been heard in the first place. But this isn't a good reason to amend this bill, amend this statute. In the creation of it, the term was modeled after the unlicensed mental health practitioners. We do have relationships with our clients that are very, well, that are intimate, and that we need clear boundaries, and the consumer needs clear boundaries. It's found in other statutes, as the document that I have presented you lists here, and as they have said, it is in other statutes in our state. This was developed to protect the consumer from the erosion and the breach of their rights and boundaries. This created a clear line for the for the practitioner to consider in dealing with their clients. This was the language that was put forth, and what it does is it not only protects the consumer, but it also protects the practitioner from having a client say, well, that was a great massage, how about we go to dinner? I'm now a former client. When they have the protection, when they understand that I have given you a document as in compliance with the CAM law, what it says is that I cannot date you. I cannot have sexual relationships with you. I cannot do these things. And it's very clear. The consumer is protected. The practitioner is protected. This amendment is supported by a national group that did not support other consumer protection bills in the same field. They have not been there. And to amend a bill that takes away consumer protections, that says, well, you know, you can, and it's fuzzy, makes for a problem in the field. Greg Schmidt is with me from the National Group.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Gregory Schmidt. I'm president of Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. As you heard last week, we are a consumer organization. When we all were working on the language and the bill that created Chapter 146A, we wanted to be taken seriously. That meant that there were some provisions that went into that crafting of that bill that, while they may have seemed onerous to some people, were generally agreed on by both consumers and practitioners to be of benefit. We believe that this is not an unreasonable language that's in the statute, and see no reason to change it because of one isolated incident that may have been better handled. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess how do we work this, though, that if a similar situation does occur where someone legitimately finds some connection there, you know, and do they have to abandon their profession to have a relationship, or wait 3 years, or how would you suggest it would be something like that addressed versus what's being proposed?
If the love of your life has walked in the door, that's where you have to make that decision. The Minnesota Therapeutic Massage Network has helped their members to go through this and understand what this means. Sometimes other organizations have not had any respect for this law, so they have not completely helped their practitioners, and that's unfortunate. But what happens with that is that if you're always taking a risk, and this is seen over and over again, whether it's doctors, lawyers, chiropractors, psychologists, yes, dating does happen, but this is about protecting abuse from abuse, and I think that is why the health department dropped the case, because they realized this was an act of malice. It was not a true risk. And to change the law because of one incident that got bizarre and got unfortunate media coverage because it was exciting. And yet what we have at risk here is something that you'll see is a problem in all of these industries.
Thank you.
Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. Really, technically, according to the law as it stands now, the Department of Health should not have dropped the case, which presents the absurdity of having it in here.
How do you mean should not have dropped the case?
Well, because they did break the law. Mr. Chair, sorry.
No, Mr. Chair,
they did break the law as it's written. Mm-hmm. So even though now you're testifying that the Department of Health should never have pursued it. Wait a minute. Whoa. It was against the law. That's what makes this law not work.
Senator Marty, Senator Ork, what we have here is that the complaint was not made by the client. The client did not bring the case. The law is set up so that if the client has been abused, and I don't believe the client was under any protection that they could not represent themselves to this. This is about clients placing a case of abuse. It's for the consumer's protection. That's why it's in other statutes as well. I would say that if we take this out, we should consider taking it out of other statutes. I don't think it's wise for the protection of the consumer.
Ms. York, when you were giving your example of somebody who gets a massage and then says, let's go out to dinner, I'm a former client, I think you could make a strong argument that they're not a former client, but they're a current client. I don't know what time period you would suggest, whether you think 2 years is appropriate, but the law would still prohibit engaging in sexual exploitation of a client or a former client as well. And I regard your point a minute ago in response to Senator Worgen was that the husband was the one who should have filed the complaint, but the law doesn't say it has to be filed by the client. The law doesn't say whether the client was harmed or not. It just says that they cannot engage in contact that may be reasonably interpreted as sexual.
Yeah.
And I think that would be interpreted by most clients as sexual. So I guess I'm not sure your point on that. And don't you think that this prohibition on sexual exploitation of a former client would cover the concern you have?
Senator Marty, the reason this language is there is because of the commonality in this field. And if you look at the complaints brought against massage therapists, let alone any other practitioner that has such an intimate relationship, it is about confusion of boundaries. The stronger we can make that boundary, the better it is for the all concerned. When we take it just to simply, when we take out the former client, it creates confusion because there's no way to determine when do they become a former client. By personal declaration?
Mr. Chairman, may
then
I
respond? You would have to have that on file. I am no longer your client.
Okay, Ms. Wolpert, go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to some of the comments that Ms. York made. I think you're absolutely right. The statute continues to prohibit exploitation of current clients, and so I think that the consumer perspective is adequately protected in the current law. The other thing to remember is that massage therapy is given in a variety of contexts. For example, it is true that some massage therapists have repeat clients that come back, but it's also true that after you run a marathon, you can go into a booth and get a massage. After you have, go work out in your health club, you can go get a massage. You can get a massage in Whole Foods. You can get a massage in a variety of contexts. And so does it make sense that the intersection, how brief it may be, between two people thereafter would prohibit people from going out and engaging in protected activities because it was in a massage context and you have to wait for 2 years? I think that the law sweeps too broadly. If you think about the First Amendment, for example, when people talk, sometimes they cause danger. And the solution isn't to ban everyone from talking. The solution is the marketplace of ideas. Similarly, this statute sweeps too broadly. We can protect consumers. We have statutes, criminal statutes, that protect against prostitution and sex for money. And we also have this current statute that prohibits exploitation and sexual activities with current clients. I think that sweep is broad enough, and we don't need to get so broad that we are in the bedrooms of marital couples.
Senator Marty.
Go ahead, Ms.
This is brought by a massage therapy incident, but this is about complementary and alternative medicine, which includes naturopathic physicians. It includes homeopathists. It includes many different fields. This is about one practice. It is about a bigger scope, and that's why it serves so well, because it includes so many practices and makes it clear.
Senator Erickson-Ropes and Senator Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the witnesses. And I think your last point about it being applying to many practices, still in my mind, allows these people to be covered while they're clients. I think the greatest point of possibilities for exploitation is, you know, during the client-professional relationship. And I'm a nurse, and, you know, we were told all that stuff, too, about you can't marry your patients, you can't date your patients, and all of that. But I'll have to check statute, but I don't know if nurses can have to wait 2 years in order to date a former patient or not. I'm not really sure. But it seems to me we should be doing whatever we can to protect people in the context of a professional relationship. And once that is ended, then they become two adults in the world who may or may not want to pursue a personal relationship. So I think we need to start looking at the social workers, for heaven's sakes. If they want to make, I mean, that's a lifetime ban. You know, I think once you get outside the boundaries of your professional relationship, then people should be on their own to make adult decisions about how they want to proceed with their lives.
Senator
Schmidt,
Senator Ropes. I had a client return to me after 2 years, just recently. If I were in a small town and I had overstepped my boundaries and I was the only massage therapist in town, they would have no place to go. If I were the only naturopath in town and they had no other option, and they didn't have access to because of the confusion of the boundaries. I can't stress how strongly these boundaries have served so well. On a national basis, the number one complaint in professional liability insurance is between practitioner and client, and that you never know when that person wants to come back to you.
Senator Corin.
Mr. Chairman, I would just say that this senator is looking at this, and it seems to be pretty darn reasonable to me. So with that, I would move that Senate File 3000 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
As amended.
As amended.
On that motion, Senator Wergen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was actually going to suggest, because I don't think just changing those couple words actually fixes the problem. And someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you almost have to eliminate the sentence that begins on the end of line 2.8 and continues through 2.11.
The amendment does that. You're picking the right things to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're right on track. Senator Martin, may I have
Mr. Chairman, I would renew my motion that Senate File 3000 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate.
Let me ask briefly if anybody else in the audience wanted to comment on this.
I just wanted to know what that amendment was.
The amendment was to delete the language at the beginning at the end of line 2.8 going through 2.11, and it also deleted lines 3.8 through 3.10. Is there further discussion from members of the committee? If not, all those in favor of Senator Coring's motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scheid, are you in the room?
I am. Just trying to fix it.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. excuse me, Senate File 2850 has to do with a bill that was passed in 2006 having to do with the absent day policies of child care providers. And we amended it at the time because I believe that you're allowed 25 absences a year, and after that, a child care provider wouldn't be reimbursed by the county for the child care you were receiving. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice. But we excluded illnesses due to when the parent or the child was sick. And we said that a school or a public health nurse could say that somebody was sick. We allowed a child care provider to verify that a child was sent home when they were sick. And then we also excluded teen parents who are in certain teen programs unable to get their child to child care, and then allows counties to pay for more absent days if the local practice justifies it. And what the legislature did this in 2006, and the effective date, the bill is a little, but looking at the bill certainly doesn't tell you what it does. So I had to tell you what we did in 2006 to get you, excuse me, did we change that then in 2007 as well?
That could pass in 2007.
That's January. I wonder how it ended up in Minnesota statutes 2006. I'm not sure, but I think we did it in 2006, I thought. I'm not sure of that, but in any case, the effective date for that portion was January 1st, 2009. And what we're doing is striking that and making it effective as of now. And I'm sure that there's a cost. I think it's estimated about $200,000. Did you tell me that? But the truth of the matter is that in these economic times, people who are needing child care, the last thing they need is to lose their child care because of absent days, and whether or not they were sick or their child or both at different times. And that's what the bill does. I'd like to.
So would the reimbursement go back to last July, or would it be beginning today in effect? Day of filing, following final enactment?
Mr. Chairman, it would, you know, the language says it's effective January 1, 2008, but then it says the section's effective the day following final enactment. So it would be
not retroactive. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I'm confused. All of those provisions that you talked about were in Section 13? The piece that's being deleted, or the
in subdivision 7 of 119B.13?
No.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman, Section 13 would have been the section of the bill, yes.
And on all of those provisions that you just talked about were in that section?
And I'm not looking at that language. I'm going to let speak.
Senator Marty, members of the committee, I'm Katie Williams, longtime child care provider for the YWCA in Minneapolis, where most of the children we serve are on the child care assistance program. And this bill that was passed was to fix, clarify the absence day policies of the state for children on child care assistance. And it was passed by the legislature, and what we're asking for now is just to move up the effective date so that those clarifications that were made would go into effect sooner, because families are losing their child care over this issue. And the sooner we can put it into effect, the better off they'll be.
Okay, so Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I got it now. I think this was the big Health and Human Services bill that this was in. So the section that you were talking about, all of those provisions were in this one section. Okay, now I've got it. Okay. But I think that was last year.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I hadn't realized that we had delayed the effective date for this because I know we have a lot of discussions with the child care agencies in my district. And I hadn't realized that we had done that. So it must have been for cost.
Senator Scheid. I thought you were signaled you wanted recognition.
Pardon me, Mr.
Chairman. Did you want to say something?
Mr. Chairman, no. I mean, it's Senator Higgins, I think, clarified it. And
Senate Counsel is saying we need the A1 amendment to clarify the effective date further. Is what?
I didn't know that, but that's fine.
I'm not quite sure why myself yet, but we will take her word for it. And, Senator Torres-Ray moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill?
So, Chairman, will I be able to have a copy of that? I just
you
need
sure
that
can.
A1. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move Senate File 2850.
Sure. Thank you.
And that it be recommended to pass and refer to
Finance.
They did not request it, but you are saying, Senator Scheid, that there is a cost to moving it up.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, there has to be, I'm guessing. Because the reimbursements, we're asking that the reimbursement or the child care assistance be paid if somebody has more absences than are currently allowed because of illness and or those other things okay. I described.
On Senator Torres-Ray's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Scheid.
Chairman and members, thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray is going to present Senate File 3423, the Health Interpreters Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am presenting this bill on behalf of Senator Moore, who is not able to be here tonight. Senate File 3423 intends to establish a registry of spoken language interpreters in Minnesota. This bill really intends to solve a significant to help us address a significant need in the state of Minnesota as we have more and more patients that speak different languages and providers encounter some challenges in trying to deliver effective services in the language of the patient. Through this bill, we will begin to establish a process to identify high-quality spoken language interpreters so that the different providers can manage the services better and improve the quality of interpretation available in the state of Minnesota. With me, I have three experts in the field who wish to testify to speak about the need to establish this particular registry. But before I move that, I need to present an amendment to Senate File 3423, which intake. Okay.
This is the A1 amendment.
And let me just explain, Mr. Chairman, that originally we intended to look at inserting some provisions in this legislation to look at the issue of cost and how these particular services are being paid, but there are some we couldn't come up with an agreement between the different players, so we decided to delete those particular provisions related to the cost and payment of these services and leave that for a later date and give this particular bill an opportunity, give Senator Mua perhaps the opportunity to present this. In this case, I'm presenting this on her behalf so that you can take a look at the most pressing need right now to establish some consistency in interpretation, and then we will talk about the need to address issues related to cost later on as we proceed to talk to the different players. So I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Senator Torres-Jay moves the A1 amendment, incorporating taking the word fund out of the deletion on line page 3, line 16. You need to keep the word fund in there. On that motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. And I would like to start with Ms. Catherine Kemet, if you could please.
Members of the committee, my name is Catherine Kemet. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I'll be very brief. This bill in front of you really represents the work that was done over the summer by the Interpreter Services Work Group, which was a group of stakeholders convened by the Department of Health to look at all of the issues relating to interpreter services in the state of Minnesota, whether how many interpreters do we have, what kind of services, what types of languages, how are they paid for, what's the access like for people across the state, and that sort of thing. What about the quality of interpreter services? And so one of the things that we were all able to come to an agreement on was the need to establish a registry, and that is what this legislation does. We still are in discussions about what's the about the best way to pay for it, but at this point, we are all in agreement that the physicians, the clinics, the health plans, the interpreters, the agencies that represent interpreters are in agreement that this is the appropriate direction to take at this time to get that registry established. And with that, I'll turn it over to Carol Berg, who has a little more background about why there's a need for establishing a registry.
Ms. Berg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carol Berg. UCARE is where I work as public health manager, but I'm currently the chair of the interpreting stakeholder group, and so I'm here tonight to just say a few words on behalf of the interpreting stakeholder group in support of this legislation. We have been actually working on this as a priority of our group to try to move this forward, so we are very happy to see this legislation before you. By way of background, you have a handout. I just wanted to make sure staff have given that to you. It's a PowerPoint just for your reference, and I'll go through it quickly. Bless you. By way of background, just so you know, the Interpreting Stakeholder Group began meeting as a committee under the Upper Midwest Translators and Interpreters Association, UMSHA is the acronym, in January 2004. So we've been meeting for several years with the mission to cooperatively improve the delivery of spoken language interpreter services in Minnesota and to promote the professionalization of interpreters as a whole. And the next, on page 2, you see in this slide that we list for your information the broad array of organizations that make up the ISG. So it's people who are interpreters themselves, people who are involved with training interpreters, those who use interpreters in the healthcare industry, also those members from different state agencies, area health education centers from around the state, and the Minnesota Supreme Court. And we have a slide here just to indicate that there is a lot of research that we want to let you know that we can share with you if you want. But there are many things that indicate the need for language services to bridge that language gap. Some of the reasons we need to have language services are listed here. There are a number of mandates that require that we provide interpreter services, as you see there. There are many financial reasons and quality health care concerns we have if you don't bridge the language gap, as well as the demographics in our state that would require that we provide interpreter services. And on the next page, you just see that we list from the 2000 census to give you a sense, and this has grown since then, of course, that at least 8.5% of families indicate that they spoke languages other than English in their home, and we know that that's increasing. and the languages are growing as far as number of languages we need to address. And so just, again, for you to have the background, there, the next few slides give you some studies that have indicated the importance of interpreter services in the healthcare field, the critical role that they play. And so that is just to let you know that we can measure the difference in the impact that interpreters make. The next slide on page 4 indicates the consequences of not having trained interpreters at hand to be able to help limited English proficient patients access services, what can occur. I won't read through all of this. This is I don't want to take your time, but if you're interested, we can share more. And in contrast, the difference it makes when you use a professionally trained interpreter, that they lead to much better outcomes and help us to address health disparities, eliminating disparities, and reducing costs to the healthcare field. And so in summary, on page 5, just to say that in out of the Interpreter Services Work Group report, you can find more information about this, that we can demonstrate that using trained interpreters can increase patient and provider satisfaction. It increases patients' perceived understanding of their health care, their health needs, and what to do about it, to improve patients' primary care utilization and improve patients' health outcomes. And that using trained interpreters may also reduce costly complications, and that may cover and lower the cost of care in the long run by using trained interpreters. And so in closing, I would just say that we are continuing to work as a stakeholder group on trying to coordinate training efforts to make sure that everybody serving in this capacity is professionally trained. And we want to partner with other states to establish a certification process for healthcare interpreters, which does not exist right now. And then also we're wanting to, again, be partnering with others to establish this statewide registry. And so the next slide lets you know that we are training interpreters who have not been through professional training yet in this nationally approved standards for code of ethics, as well as practice standards, and that we are, again, not reinventing the wheel, but we're partnering at the national level to establish a certification process, and explains a little bit about that in this slide, and that we have liaison through Dr. Downing to this national group on certification, and that we really need this interpreter registry for the following reasons listed in the slide on page 7, to help establish a baseline for interpreters by language, by service area throughout Minnesota, that we need to, it will help us to identify the gaps of where we do not have adequate interpreters to serve the LEP clients, and that we need to have a better connection with the people who are working in this capacity to help them get into training if they've not been trained yet, and to help locate interpreters when we need to arrange these services for LEP patients. And so, in closing, we really are supportive of this current legislation, and that we would like to see the registry require the elements that you see in the last slide there, which are, it, this is included in the legislation. So we support this going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Byrd. Questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And I have Mr. Jose Gonzalez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jose Gonzalez. I am an immigrant from Mexico. I was already speaking Spanish when I was brought to the U.S. at the age of 3. Once here, my parents instituted a rule in our home. We were not allowed to speak English in the home unless there was someone who could not understand Spanish. This rule was primarily intended to develop and sustain our Spanish-speaking skills. However, it also was explicitly stated that this rule was intended to be respectful of guests in our home. This rule helped me to learn to read and write Spanish fluently, while we all, every member in our family, eventually learned to speak English. I was the first person in our home to learn to speak English fluently. By the time I was entering the first grade, I was already the designated family interpreter for all health, business, and consumer transactions. That was almost 45 years ago. Since then, I have attained a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's degree in social work from the University of Minnesota. I have almost 30 years of experience in helping various populations of all age groups get their needs met, especially populations with limited English-speaking proficiency. More recently, I was the former public health clinic social work supervisor and manager of the interpreter program for the city of Minneapolis. I also was an original member of the Interpreter Standards Advisory Committee that in 1998 produced the report that Ms. Berg referred to. This produced all the recommendations back then in 98 for the training, certification, and use of foreign language interpreters. If nothing else, I want my testimony to help you understand that my personal and professional experience and skills do not, and I repeat, do not in any way make me a qualified interpreter. I believe I was a very good Spanish-speaking social worker, but never for one second did I believe I could responsibly interpret for the nurses, nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, or doctors in our public health clinics. One, I was never trained on interpreting skills or ethics. Two, I was never trained on medical terminology. I do not know the Spanish words for uterus or urethra, but I am sure knowing makes a world of difference to both a patient and a medical provider for many health and legal reasons. Without having well-trained interpreters, patients do not know if their health concerns are being adequately conveyed to medical providers, and medical providers have no way of knowing if their diagnostic questions are being conveyed or answered correctly, or if their treatment plans and medication instructions are being interpreted safely. This is dangerous. A registry of trained interpreters whose training and English and foreign language skills have already been scrutinized as meeting established standards and completed approved curricula would be a huge resource to the providers. Here, I feel I also must stress the importance of assessing an interpreter's foreign language skills. On the community side, unfortunately, there are many stories of predators that force new immigrants and refugees to use their interpretive, translating, or transportation services and pay outrageous prices, never sharing the fact if they are already being reimbursed for their services. This happens more often than we are made aware. Many interpreters pass themselves off as being certified to patient and medical provider consumers. And as you are learning here today, there is no such animal as a certified interpreter. Many predators who own interpreter services pay a fraction of what they are reimbursed to the actual interpreter. A registry and certification infrastructure for interpreters would go a long way to ending such abuses. In the past century, there have been many public health achievements that contributed greatly to overall health improvements. Public health and philanthropy contributed greatly to the research and data collection that justified legislative and policy change necessary to support the changes in infrastructure and the financial means to maintain these changes. At some point, it fell to the legislators to take the next steps to make these critical changes permanent. The leadership of people like Dr. Bruce Downing and Carol Berg and others have gotten us this far. The state of Minnesota needs for you to take the critical next step in taking what we have learned to reduce our state health disparity and protect the health and well-being for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez. A question from members of the committee. There was one other witness who wanted to testify, I believe, as well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey Sylvester. I am chairman of the Minnesota Medical Group Management Association Government Affairs Committee, and I'm also the vice president for clinic operations at Health East here in St. Paul. The Medical Group Management Association represents over 800 medical group and clinic administrators around the state of Minnesota. MMGMA, or the Medical Group Management Association, supports the authorization of an interpreter service registry. We believe the registry is a very good first step toward measuring the quality of interpreters in Minnesota and is consistent with the recommendations of the Interpreter Services Work Group, as mentioned earlier. The Interpreter Services Work Group, though, that met this past summer, fall and winter, did not reach agreement on the funding mechanism for the interpreter services. and we're very concerned about that. Clinics within Health East will continue to arrange and pay for the cost of interpreters. My clinic system has paid about $120,000 this past year in interpreter services, and we will continue to deliver services as a result of the need for these interpreter services. However, I think that the past people who just testified pointed out their testimony that we really do need to solve this problem of the cost of good quality interpreters. We're very concerned about that. We would believe that the really only place where this can be adequately done is with the health plans. Providers currently are not reimbursed for interpreter services, and this creates a huge issue for us. This is not, of course, the case with public health plans or workers' comp claims or no-fault auto claims that do reimburse for the services, although at a quite a low rate. The only patients who really don't reimburse us for this service are those that are covered by commercial insurance. In conclusion, I'd like to say that the Medical Group Management Association supports this Senate bill 3423 as amended. This concludes my remarks, and I'd certainly be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Is there anybody else who needed to speak to the bill? Is there a discussion of the bill? Senator Ray, Senate Counsel points out that we probably don't want to put this in statute. It should be session laws, which would mean you would delete the 144.058 on line 1.7, because we are referring to session laws in it, and there's nothing permanent in there. It's a task force, in effect, and setting up a process. So, Senator Torres Ray, would you mind moving to delete the statutory reference on line 7 of page 1?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill. It looks to me like you've got everything solved, but how is it going to get paid for? Which is probably the biggest issue that's been going on.
Not yet, Mr. Chair. So I would like to move Senate File 3423 to be recommended to pass. And
we think it has to go to state and local government because it has a working group and advisory group in it.
Okay, and be referred to state and local government.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You.
Thank you, members.
Is Senator Betzold in the room? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 3225 was brought to me by the Ombudsman from the Department of Human Services, and I'll describe it as best as I can, but I may have to ask some clarification by the department on why this bill is here. The Ombudsman brought me this bill with concern that the Ombudsman's office, in order to perform their duties in representing their clients, the patients, the individuals who receive services from the Department of Human Services, they often need access to records. And not just from the Department of Human Services, but there's some like 12,000 facilities that may be served that they have to have access to. It's my understanding that the department has interpreted some of the HIPAA regulations to determine that they are not, they should not have access to the records, or if they have access to them, they can look at the records, but they can't copy them. So this bill would actually clarify the role of the Ombudsman's office in their oversight so that they can gather information. It would still maintain whatever category of classification. If it's not public information, it would still maintain that. There are references to the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 42, Section 2.15, and that actually that deals with the confidentiality of alcohol and drug abuse patient records. and also with deceased patients' vital statistics. So I do have Roberta Opine here from the Ombudsman to discuss the need for this bill, and that, in a nutshell, Mr. Chair, is the bill.
Welcome to the committee.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roberta Opine. I'm the State Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and we're charged with promoting the highest standards of treatment and justice for persons who receive services for mental illness, developmental disabilities, chemical dependency, and emotional disturbance in children. This is really not a bill asking for anything more than to add the word copies. All the rest of it is housekeeping or cleanup language, and this is brought about because of a rather sudden change of interpretation to say that since our legislation says we can have access to records, we can come and look at them, but if we want a copy of them, we can't have a copy. Now, for 20 years, we've been getting copies from all the facilities that we've worked with, all the agencies we've worked with. But there is a concern that absent of including the word copies, that somehow the legislature either neglected to put it in or didn't want us to have copies. So that's all the rest of it, again, is cross-references and housekeeping language.
Senator Worgen.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Opheim, I don't quite see the one sentence on one page 1, line 10 as housekeeping. It says, client also includes now a deceased person who is served by an agency, facility, or program. That means after someone's died, you can continue to get records and stuff. That's, I don't think that's real technical. I don't know why that's necessary.
Ms. Opheim.
Chair, Senator Worgen, we've always had a responsibility. The number one priority within the agency that the legislature gave us was to review the deaths of persons who have died while receiving services. So we've always reviewed the deaths. The only thing we would gather records for at the time of death would be to see, were there problems with the death? Were there gaps in the system? Was there a lack of continuity of care or failure to treat early? So without that, again, we didn't ask for that particular change. That was just recommended as a clarifier by the Information Policy Analysis Division. We've never had a problem getting death records in the past until this sudden and abrupt change in interpretation of the law. Again, we've been doing this for 20 years.
Further discussion from the committee. Is there anyone in the audience who wanted to speak to this bill? Senator Higgins? Make a motion?
Sure, I'll move the bill.
This one goes to judiciary, I believe.
Oh, goody, I get to hear it again.
Senator Higgins moved Senate File 3225. You recommend it pass, referred to the committee on judiciary. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you both. Senator Scogin, apparently you came at the right time. Welcome to the committee, and go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. Tonight we're going to deal with Senate File 3256, a licensing requirements for what up in Wadena and Otter Tail County we call DACs. Before I start, though, Mr. Chair, I would like to offer an author's amendment.
Senator Higgins moves we don't have it yet. We'll distribute
D-A-1.
It. Just go ahead and explain it, and we'll explain the bill with it in it, and we'll adopt it in a minute.
Jerry Kerber is with me this evening, Senator, and our Mr. Chair, and I'd like to just turn things over to him. And
Jerry Miller. Jerry Kerber is here, too, though.
Well, he's right there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Jerry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Marty, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Miller. I'm the executive director of MNDAC, and we represent day training and habilitation programs. There are approximately 230 programs in the state of Minnesota in all of the counties, and we serve about 14,000 people. This bill will affect, I believe, about 22 of the programs. In total, there's about 45 different facilities that will be affected by it, according to the department. And what it does is it, right now, if you have buildings that are on the same property, that are adjacent to each other, and on continuous property, and they're not connected, you have to have two licenses for them. We would change it so those cases you'd only have to have one license. The other thing that this does, it would, if a program has a central office and satellites with someplace within the same county, it would allow those satellites to be licensed as satellites. And other than that, it does not affect the rates. It does not affect any of the standards and how they would be applied, the quality of the programs, the ability of the licensing to do their job. And we have talked to the department and to the Department of Licensing about this, and they have offered an amendment, and we're fine with it. What it does, it clarifies the rates, and it establishes, it basically says the rates will remain the same, or the application of the rates will remain the same, and that is just fine with us.
That's based on participants. I stumbled upon it by accident, Mr. Chair and committee. In Wadena County, we were having a kind of a regional meeting, and they have two buildings that are less than probably 20 feet apart. Same clients use both buildings. You get into thread sheds or DAC stores, and they're being required to be licensed in both facilities, even though there's no separation of program there. They just walk on a little wooden plank from building to building considering funding and trying to stretch these DAC dollars as far as possible. They were wondering if we could make an adjustment on how they are licensed when they are similar or nearby each other, these facilities.
So, but because the license fee would be the same, the savings is because they don't have to go through the licensing process twice.
That's correct.
Is there discussion on those? Senator Worgen.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Miller, the only question I have is that in some ways, I understand that you don't want to have two different licenses, and I don't have a problem with that, but if the buildings are licensed. I'm thinking of Mille Lacs County.
Yep.
I'm familiar with that. In the Mille Lacs area DSC. They have a building in Malacca and a building in Princeton, and each building is licensed. Well, currently, if something would happen that one building has to be closed, that license could be revoked, but the other one could stay open. But if something would happen under this scenario, you'd have to close all of your buildings. Is that what you want?
Is Princeton Mille Lacs County? Is that it is? We thought of that, and we thought that the benefits of this would still override the that consideration. It's kind of like a program is only good as its weakest link, and these programs have been around now for 40 years. They know what's expected of them, and by and large, they're in compliance with most of it. If there's something wrong, then more than likely, the whole that's going to permeate through the entire program. So we thought of it, and your Senator Worgen, your consideration is appreciated, but we think it would still be better this way.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Worgen.
Mr. Chair, if the DTNHs don't care, I don't. I was just trying to know.
Thank you, Senator.
Is it possible that, if the department had, if there was a problem with the licensure of one of them, they could shut down one facility but not the entire license, you're saying?
They could. If this shifts, they theoretically could, I believe, shut down both. But if that happens, and I don't believe it ever has, and I haven't been here 25 years, there would be serious problems throughout that facility, and it would, I suppose, theoretically,
Mr. Chair, I tried to get Jerry Kerber up here to start with. Maybe we could bring him to the table now.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber. I'm from the Department of Human Services and the Licensing Division. Senator Waring, to answer your question, right now in the law there's a provision that says that if we revoke one license of a license holder, that license holder is prohibited from holding any other licenses for 5 years anyway. But the other thing that I would point out here is that it's sort of voluntary. The way the bill is drafted, it's up to the provider to decide whether or not they want to have one license that serves two locations or whether they want to continue to have two licenses that serve two locations. And in the amendment, you can see that there's a nice provision the legislature adopted a few years ago that gives them a break on the fee for that second license if 50% or more than 50% of the people from facility A go to facility B. And so it just provides another option, really, for the license holders to decide.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Senator Worgen.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that 3256 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
Senator Worgen moves the A1 amendment first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, I have a little amendment.
Senator Higgins.
On line 1.21, delete the comma that and make it and. It's affiliated with the central operations and is in a separate adjacent building. I think that makes a little more sense.
So, Senator Higgins moves that technical amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Worgen moves the Senate file 3256 as amended to be recommended pass. Further discussion, Senator Scogin?
Thank you.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Thank you.
Senator Torres, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're going to take the Senate File 2847. That's the establishment of a child care advisory task force. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the intent of this legislation is really to facilitate a conversation that is long overdue in terms of providing the Department of Human Services an opportunity to discuss with providers several issues of concerns with respect to provisions for child care and review recommendations that to address barriers that families face when they need to apply for child care assistance. And the intent is to establish a process through which we will make this system more clear and more user-friendly. And before I move that, I need to move the A1 amendment, which is a change on a date that was originally proposed but apparently does not give the department enough time to really look into the different recommendations and aspects of child care services. And as a result, they recommend that we move to insert 2010 instead of 2009, Mr. Chairman and members, and I would like to move that amendment.
Senator Torres-Ray moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. And I have with me Ms. Katie Williams, who is the chair of the Kids Care Connection and board member of the Child Care Works, to speak about this issue.
Thank you. Senator Marty, members of the committee, I'm Katie Williams, longtime director of child care programs that serve low-income children on the Child Care Assistance Program. We have a terrible problem in that our process for applying for child care assistance and then for being reauthorized is very complex and very confusing and overwhelming to parents. The paperwork is very lengthy. Some of the parents don't understand the paperwork or understand the process. It's also a very slow process. And the result is that many of our families that are most at risk and whose children are most at risk
are and most eligible for child care assistance aren't getting it because they are overwhelmed by the process, or they get it and then lose it. And these are the very families that, if they manage to get a job, we really want them to be able to go ahead and take that job, but they can't do it without child care. And then we want them to be able to hang on to the job and have their children stay in good child care and stable situations. So this opportunity to see what can be done to reduce barriers and speed up the process and make it much more available to families that are eligible will be very, very helpful.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? A lot of excitement or controversy. Is there anyone? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, is this application similar to other DHS applications, and it's like 20, 30 pages long?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, yes. And there have been a series of recommendations to amend this, and there are other issues with respect to eligibility. And in order to really take a look at what is happening and how can the department best address these issues, I think they are recommending that we put together a group that look at all of these aspects of child care subsidies and services so that we can come up with all the recommendations at once rather than, you know, trying to look at the application and other pieces that are related to these services.
Mr. Chair, I know in years past I've amended bills like this to require that the application be no more than 4 pages long. And I won't do that, but I think that's a good goal for the group is to try to figure out how to get that form down. I can't imagine filling out a 20-page form, especially when, since I've looked at the form, I know that it asks you the same question like 3 or 4 times just to see if you answer it differently. And beyond time-wasting, it's insulting. And so I don't know where the department is with their one application for all uses at a reasonable size, but they need to get to it and get to it fast. Now I'm done haranguing.
Senator Torres-Ray, I was interested in the language the reviser put in this bill under expenses, because you're dealing with people, often low-income people, which a lot of child care advocates are, an anti-poverty advocacy community, and you're mandating that they must not be paid per diem or reimbursed for any expenses. I thought we usually stay silent if we're not giving somebody any reimbursement, but here we're mandating that they cannot receive any. I'm not sure for the purpose of that, but
to keep maybe it off.
Mr. Chair?
Compensation.
Perhaps that's a recognition of the budget constraints.
Usually we just... Okay, because unless we do that, they would be.
Oh. Well, Mr. Chairman, I assume that the reason is that they really want to get this done, and so they don't want to have the question about, you know, I assume the department recommended that we put this language if we want to get it done, and they really want to get it done. So
probably could have said it in a little more positive manner, but I won't complain. Senator Torres-Ray moves that Senate file 2847 be, as amended, be recommended, passed, referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Torres-Ray, you want to take up your other bill right now?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. My next bill is Senate 3320, which modifies the shelter needy provisions for Minnesota Supplemental Aid to include persons moving out of corporate foster care settings. And, Mr. Chair, I understand that they... there was a question at the beginning of this conversation that this had a fiscal note, and it doesn't. So it will move directly from the floor if it is supported by this group, by this committee. And this bill, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, intends to increase opportunities for persons who are disabled and who live that need to live in the community and are able to live in the community and are able to access additional housing funds under the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program. And with me, I have I have a couple of testifiers from Dakota County, Director of Employment and Economic Assistance, and a board commissioner that wish to testify on behalf of this and answer questions from members.
Go ahead.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Schuweiler, a Dakota County Commissioner and Chair of the County Board. I'm also here representing MAXA. The additional Minnesota Supplemental Aid Special Needs Allowance for disabled individuals under the age of 65 assists them in affording housing, which allows them the opportunity to integrate into the community upon release from a treatment center or nursing facility. However, our experience in Dakota County is that often these persons are still in need of 24-hour supervision and therefore are placed in corporate foster care settings using MA waiver funds. The Dakota County Board of Commissioners respectfully requests amending the statute to include licensed corporate foster care homes among the settings for which the additional Minnesota Supplemental Aid Needs Allowance is provided. This amendment will reduce the demand to use limited medical assistance waiver funds and facilitate the movement of these individuals from their more costly institutions. Without this amendment, disabled individuals who are able to live without 24-hour supervision will continue to live in corporate foster care homes, expending limited MA waiver resources. In addition, others who are in more costly institutions will endure longer waiting periods before moving into community placements, adding an unnecessary burden to county costs for mental health commitments. This amendment will assure our disabled individuals will live in the most appropriate setting for their needs and the most cost-effectively, creating a win-win situation for this population and our taxpayers. On behalf of the County Board, I thank you for your time and consideration of our request.
Thank you, Ms. Schuweiler.
Thank you.
Ruth Kruger, I'm the legislative co-chair for the Minnesota Social Services Administrators, the MAXA group. And so I just wanted to stress that this is brought to you by all of the counties. It originated with Dakota County. We were looking at the 350 to 400 corporate foster care settings that we have and looking at how we needed to move people out of those corporate foster care into less restrictive so that they could gradually become more and more a part of the community. But unless we were able to find affordable rent and services for them, we couldn't do that. So while they still would be covered under the waiver, it would be a lot less expensive. And so we went to the department several years ago, talked this through, and it would simply be moving things from one state pot to another to facilitate this, and we were not able to figure out how there would be a fiscal note to that, and the department helped us with the technical piece of that.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? If not, Senator, is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to speak to this? If not, Senator Torres-Ray moves that Senate File 3320 be recommended to pass, and I believe this goes straight to the floor.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it goes directly to the floor.
Okay. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you,
Thank
members.
Thank you. Is Senator Sharon around yet?
No.
No. We'll take Senator Lori then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've got really two bills out of a three-part package before you here today. It's called the Ready to Launch Support for Success for Youth Aging Out of Our Foster Care System. And each year in Minnesota, about somewhere between 450 and 600 youth are leaving home. These are youth that have been removed from their families, have lived in foster care, and not received permanent homes. And therefore, when they leave the foster care system, these are youth that are truly alone. And foster youth, as you can imagine, are no more ready for independence at age 18 than their non-foster care peers. A couple of statistics, 95% of Americans are 25 or older before they are able to live self-sufficiently. And I think that many of us who are parents can understand that and have seen the difficult transitions for non-foster youth into adulthood can be. Recent estimates suggest that parents provide their young adult children with material assistance totaling approximately $38,000 between the ages of 18 and 34, and parent time assisting their 18 to 34-year-old children averages 367 hours per year. Again, these are statistics that I think resonate with anybody who's a parent or watched the often painful transition into adulthood, even for non-foster youth. And compared to their peers, these youth aging out of the foster care system are, on average, less likely to have a high school diploma. They are less likely to be pursuing higher education. They are less likely to be earning a living wage. They are more likely to have experienced economic hardships. They are more likely to have had a child out of wedlock and more likely to have been involved with the criminal justice system. So the case really is that even in monetary terms alone, we've made a significant investment through our foster care system, which is a good and wise investment in these youth. But to just turn it off at age 18 is oftentimes problematic for those, again, whom we've found no permanent home for. So this is, again, a three-part package. The first part is to require accountability for the independent living plan through a court review prior to court dismissal of jurisdiction. That piece is being carried in Patricia Torres-Ray bill on child welfare, so we won't be talking about that tonight. The second part is establishing automatic Medicaid coverage for youth aging out of the foster care system up to age 21, again, to back up the investments that we've already made and help them a little bit with some support services that they're very accustomed to utilizing, and these are at-risk youth still. The third part is the first bill before us today, and that's to allow youth to remain in care or return to care up to age 21. That is the bill that we have before you right now, Senate File 3145, and I do have an author's amendment for this. It is the A1. I would like to offer that at this time.
Senator Horry moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I'd like to delete line 5 of the A1 amendment because we don't need that comma.
You don't need a comma there. I would consider that a friendly amendment if it is correct.
We'll incorporate that into it. Not include line 1.5 in the amendment. Senator Lori moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay, so then we have Senate File 3145 before us. Again, it really allows youth to remain in foster care, to remain in care or return to care up to age 21. I've got a couple of folks here, I'd like to help answer questions about it, if that would be all right.
Sure.
Mary Reagan is here to answer some questions. And we also have Rochelle Doherty, a Master of Social Work student, who has some very personal experiences with these issues, as well as Emerald McKay. Is that
McCoy?
Okay, well, I'd like to ask them to come to the witness table.
They all come forward. And if we could hear maybe some of the personal experiences and stories about this quickly. Brief comments, but it would be helpful if we hear something.
And we will be very brief.
Go ahead and identify yourself and then begin.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rochelle Doherty. I am a former foster care youth that is passionate about the needs of youth in care. I am currently pursuing my master's in social work at the U of M, and I'm dedicated to improving the outcomes of this population. These changes in legislation can have a dramatic effect in ensuring that youth who emancipate from state care have many of the same opportunities of other youth that are leaving home for the first time. These youth have been removed from their parents' care to provide for their safety and well-being. How can we abandon them at age 18 when, as parents, we would not do this to our own children? Most youth leaving care are at increased risk compared to other youth leaving home due to the abuse and neglect that they have encountered. Many youth leave care with the same emotional and physical damage that many times brought them into care. In my own experience, I first left home at the age of at the age of 14 after being confined to the basement for 3 days and enduring years of physical and mental abuse. After leaving, I managed to attend high school and work two jobs until my parents turned me in as a runaway almost a year later and I was placed in foster care. I managed to graduate from high school as no one in my family had ever done. I did not have any support there that day to watch me receive my diploma, and the next 6 years of my life were a constant struggle for survival. I did not have a plan for my future. Like a lot of youth who exit the foster care system, I experienced homelessness, drug abuse, domestic violence, and inadequate health care. I was at increased risk for failure as I had physical and emotional issues that had not been met. Research indicates that obtaining health coverage is difficult for more than 50% of youth exiting care. Youth leaving care also do not have the support of family to fall back on when they encounter the inevitable obstacles in life. For the majority of youth, the state relinquishes all parental responsibility at the age of 18. According to the Finance Project, the total cost of providing services to this population to ensure better opportunities for a successful transition into adulthood is small in comparison to the cost to society for the negative outcomes of this population. Investing in this transition can help them reach independence at the same pace as other youth leaving home and help them avoid the obstacles for which they are at risk. I owe my own success as an adult to having a safe place to go to at a point in my life when I did not have any other opportunities. At the age of 23, I was allowed to go home as my father was separated from his abusive wife, and I had somewhere to go for the support I did not have previously. For the majority of youth, this opportunity may never come. As decision makers in the lives of these youth, I'm asking you to take the opportunity to look over the issues presented before you today and improve the outcomes for this vulnerable population. Thank you.
Is your name Ms. Doherty?
Yes.
What you say you're seeking a master's degree in what field?
In social work.
So you, from your own experience, you decided you want to go into that field to help others?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you.
If I could run real quick on Senate File 3145, I should note that this is really in rule currently, and it is somewhat non-uniformly applied in counties across the state, and so we're bringing it from rule to statute and hoping to bring some uniformity to this ability to allow youth to stay, to maintain some level of their prior services through age 21, through this transition. And Emerald, welcome. And
good evening, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Emerald McCoy. Being that I am a former foster child, I'm aware of the challenges and struggles of these youth encounter. Coming out of a broken home, I have overcame obstacles that have been thrown at me. I have overcame the mental, physical abuse. I have overcame the negativity from family members and peers. I have endured these negative attributes and turned them into a positive. Now I am the first in my family to walk across the stage, graduate from high school, go to college, get accepted to one of the most prestigious schools in Minnesota, St. Kate's, in the 3 years that I've been here. Without the support of my social worker mentor, Scott Price, sisters and mom, and other various people that I surrounded myself by, I couldn't accomplish these things that I have done so far, or even the ability to know that I can do it. So it is of vital importance that these foster youth get these resources that are available to them, medical assistance being one. This is important for youth to have their health and have that as a responsibility, and especially for youth that are transitioning out of foster care into independent living. Getting these youth prepared for transitional house living is another vital task that is important. Giving them an opportunity to change their lives with an experience as transitional housing can cause great things for these youth. They are more college-bound, work-bound, inspired that they can make a change and provide those things to others and their siblings, or provide or give back to their communities. This is very important to me, to see these bills get passed, to see that we are opening doors and grant opportunities for others that have been less fortunate than me or other foster youth. So with that all said and done, I appreciate your time and effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCoy. Are you at St. Kate's right now?
This fall, I will be there.
What are you planning to study there?
Occupational therapy.
Wonderful. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, we share a little interest here. I like what you're doing. You threw me for a loop, though, because I really did think it was the practice. So thanks for clarifying that it is in rule, because we did have girls after 18. So I thought, whoa.
Yep.
But I'm not going to oppose your bill in any way. But I always thought pushing it to 21 was a little bit far. I don't think about that, but certainly beyond 18, because I do know that the girls that left our house so often just were not. You felt like you were just throwing them to the wolves. It was awful.
Senator Gore.
Well, I mean, I take that under advisement and know that we need to figure out some way. But again, you know, watching a lot of people very close to me through this transition, I don't think 21 is too, you know, too far out there. Again, I'd look at the statistics that go all the way to age 34, that 367 hours per year for parents with non-foster youth extends all the way to age 34. And so I think that an extra, you know, I mean, your point well understood, and I know we have to be wise stewards of the public trust in the public dollar, but I think that's about.
That right. These successes make it worth it, though.
Yeah, they really do.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's why I said I'm not going to fight
yeah.
it.
Senator Dow, did you have your hand?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator Lori, for bringing this bill forward. Being a father and a stepfather to six, I can say that 21, even in a stable home situation, can sometimes create some challenges. So if you come from an unstable family situation, yeah, you need that extra help along the way. And I'm glad you brought up those points of the 38,000. I was wondering why we have to work 7 days a week, you know, just to make, you know, pay the bills. But I appreciate what you're doing, and I support this bill.
I thought those statistics might resonate with some parents.
Senator Torres-Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say something very similar to what Senator Dolch just said. Every single friend of mine who has a child that age and send them to college, they were hoping that, you know, they were gone and they were going to find jobs, and now they are back home, all of them, and they are not able to find jobs. So I do think that the age of 21, you know, more kids are coming back home and trying to find jobs and find stability in their lives. And so I think this is a very important piece of legislation.
Senator Lori.
And I might add, you know, these are a set of services and a set of, you know, care coordinators and case managers that the youth is familiar with. And, you know, to put them into the adult world and try to get them ready to navigate a whole new system is going to be very, very foreign to them. So, again, I mean, these are people in society today who are going to be in dire need of supports somewhere. And kind of the question is, do we try to bring some of the supports that they're used to and that have helped them get as far as they have, or do we cut it off at 18 and let them be try to follow their own path through the adult world? And I think that if they, you know, it's at their choice to leave at 18, and they would still, under this rule, have that ability to leave, but it would allow them to say, well, I made a mistake in leaving, and I'd like to come back and try to tap into some of those services again, because I'm finding some things out here in the real world that aren't matching with my vision when I wanted nothing more than to leave.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lori, I think this is a great bill.
and thank you for doing this. Do you have any idea what it might cost?
We're trying to get some fiscal notes put together. We're I think that there may be we're trying to get a bead on that. We're working on it.
So probably, Mr. Chair, in the next committee you'll have a
We will in the next committee. I don't know. We're working on it. We're trying to get a bead on that.
And also,
again, it's about 450 individuals per year. And hopefully, if we look at the costs, you know, elsewhere in the system, that these individuals, there's no question in my mind that this is actually a cost-saving measure. Whether we get a fiscal note to support that or not, you know, I don't know. And I'm not saying anybody's going to be trying to kill it with a fiscal note or anything, but sometimes it's hard to track those things. I don't know how available information will be. You know, so we're working on it and trying to develop that for the next committee as we move over to finance.
Thank
you. Sarah Wergen.
Thank you, Senator Laurie. I bet the former Senator Laurie and I could share lots of stories about young adults that stayed in our home without the pay, too.
I've had a few in my home.
Thank you. Senator Laurie moves Senate File 3145. Is amended. Go ahead.
I don't know if anybody
did
else.
Did anybody else wish
testify.
To testify on this bill? If not, Senator Laurie moves Senate File 3145 as amended, be recommended pass, and referred to the Committee on Finance, I believe. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Ms. Doherty and Ms. McCoy, thank you very much for your testimony, and good luck.
Thank you.
Senator Laurie, you want to take your other bill up?
Right yeah, now? We'll just pick up Senate File 3146, which we also already pretty much explained took testimony on. This is the extension of medical assistance through age 21. I have an author's amendment, a technical correction to this one as well.
Senator Laurie moves it. A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, I have the A2 amendment.
Oh.
A2 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, I can Senator Laurie, this was not to surprise you or anything. Just I was reading this after I sat down, and I thought there's something wrong here, and I actually couldn't get a grip on it. And then I started going back over having 100 girls in our house that were teenagers and left as adults primarily. And one of the things that we always, always, always did with the girls is try to get them to be as confident and as responsible for the real life things as everybody else. And so the amendment, Senator Laurie, just says that if you look at line one.
I need to get a copy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Senator Laurie, it would be
page line 10.
Okay.
Replace the without with upon completion of an application.
It just says they have to complete an application. And the only reason I'm doing that is because one of the things that these young folks have to do is walk into the real world. And in the real world, you have to fill out applications for stuff. And their foster parents and their social worker should be there to help them fill out the application because it's part of what they have to learn for every insurance policy they take out from then on and for every school they apply to. So I'm not saying don't give them the assistance. I'm just saying help them with the application so that they learn the process as adults just like everybody else has to. And then it does take and eliminate the last sentence so that they do have to reapply. And that's not for punishment or to keep them away from the medical assistance. It's just because I'm sure your family taking foster care and my family always shared the same goal of making our young people as self-sufficient as they could when they left our home. And self-sufficiency, part of that is filling out the application to get the things you need and, you know, they have to know how to fill out paperwork. What a great lesson. What a great way to help them learn how to fill out paperwork. Start with a 30-page document. And I don't mean that as a punishment, but I mean, I think that teaches responsibility. I want them to be able to have the medical care because I know they don't have it any other way, but I want them to be responsible with the paperwork so that they learn that.
Senator Laurie. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wergen, understand where you're trying to go with this. I'm trying to wrap my head around it a little bit. I mean, it sounds like then they'd just have to. I'm wondering how seriously they would take it. At the end of the application, they fill it out. They put Mickey Mouse on there. They put whatever. They still have to. It would still read that they must be enrolled in medical assistance, correct?
Mr. Chair, I know that, and Mickey Mouse on the lines would help a social worker and a foster parent determine how much more help they might need, but I still think it's a very worthy exercise.
I'm just trying to flesh out where we're going with this. I mean, they must.
I'm just going through teaching the responsibility.
The whole goal of this piece of the package is because of a dire need, really, in these people, in these youth that are, frankly, oftentimes not ready for that level of responsibility, and a large percentage of them have simply not filled in the paperwork and are unable to access needed medical services, and that's why we're bringing this piece of legislation forward. And I think that although well-intended and understand the goals of the amendment, I think that it would kind of destroy the intent of the bill. And as such, I would, in that if these youth are unable or unwilling to fill in the paperwork today, which is, they're eligible. Almost all of them are eligible for medical assistance. And they're not receiving it because they haven't applied. And if we change it such that they get the eligibility if they apply, then we have done nothing to get these vulnerable youth the medical services that they so need. In my mind, I mean, it kind of, I understand and I really do sympathize with, I have a testifier here as well who'd like to speak to this.
Senator Worgan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lori, just one comment. It's just, you work so hard to teach them that they have to accept responsibility, because that's the goal as a foster parent. When you have teenagers in your home, you know that they're going to go out on their own when they leave, and you agonize with them figuring out how to do it. And here's another teaching opportunity. And if you just give it to them, oftentimes the kids that were in our home were generations of welfare, and they just thought things came to them. And this is a teaching tool to say, well, yeah, you do qualify, but you have to fill out this paper.
Senator Worthing? I agree with you about the importance of teaching responsibility, but I kind of wonder if the kid isn't going to be, when you're filling out something you know is meaningless, if that makes it more cynical than what your hope is to teach them responsibility. I think there are very many chances, you as a foster parent know how many chances you have to teach responsibility. I just wonder, because I think because it they are going to get it once they fill it out, and there's Senator Lori pointed out, regardless what they fill out on it. I understand your point. I'm just not sure this is the best way to accomplish that.
You want me to say it, or do you?
Senator Lynch, or how about we have the testimony first, and then we can discuss it more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. Senator Worgan, I think you're exactly right in the need for these kids to begin to take some responsibility and learn to do some of the things that they need to do in order to succeed when they leave. And actually, that is the whole focus of our court review section, which is not part of what we're talking about tonight. It's not the bill we're talking about tonight. But in that bill, what we're asking is at the annual review, any time after the age of 15, that the court look at what the foster parent, the child, and the worker are doing together in very specific list of areas to get this child ready to emancipate from foster care. And it is a team, and the child is part of that team, and the expectation in the court review will be that they are working on making sure they have health insurance, making sure that they have a place to live, making sure that they have plans for education or a job. So that is the third piece of our focus, is making sure that we are changing the message for these kids, that this isn't just about you have to put up with us until 18 and then you get to leave. But in order to be successful when you leave, these are the things that we are all going to work on together in order to make that work. So I think you're right. I think our concern with this particular piece is it's so critical, and it is one of those pieces that without an adult over your shoulder, I have a 22-year-old son, I still have to bug him. Have you paid that parking ticket? Have you completed that application? Did you let people know you moved? They're not in the future, they're in the present all the time, and we think it would be a shame to have it drop off, but we are hoping to build in all of those skills on the other side in the other piece of this.
Did you have any other testimony you wanted to give on this, or you've kind of...
Not unless there
was. Okay. Senator Lynch.
This is on the Wiergen Amendment. Is that what we're on?
The A2 one, yes.
Okay. Has it been adopted?
No. We're discussing.
Okay. Well, on that discussion, I actually like a lot of Senator Wiergen's amendment. I like the part about striking the word without, so that they do need to go through that process. But one thing that I might suggest, and maybe in the name of compromise, is on your amendment on line 1.3. I'm not so interested in that particular portion of the amendment, and my rationale is this, and we have seen this in some other application, public program sorts of things, where in the name of the game here is we are really trying to get all of those currently uninsured that are eligible enrolled. And as I look at it, this is a pretty finite group of individuals, 18 to 21. And so I guess I'm comfortable with not having that reapplication an ongoing thing. And I'm thinking of administrative expense and administrative hoops and trying to streamline processes and making eligibility more easily accessible for those that are eligible. So I just offer that as sort of a compromise, if you will.
Senator Wiergen.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to accept that as a friendly amendment to my amendment to delete 1.1 left. Yeah, page 1, line 3 of the amendment.
Senator Wiergen, why don't you just incorporate that into your amendment?
I will, thank you.
Well, with that, I think that we can get the youth, as they're approaching age 18, to fill out an initial application and use it as a learning tool, and would at this point consider the A2 amendment with that amendment dropping line 1.3. Consider it a friendly amendment.
So Senator Wiergen moves the A2 amendment with deleting line 3 of that. Any further discussion on that? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to go back to the agreement we just did, to take off the amendment, the deletion, and so we're reinserting this reapplication is no longer required. Is that typically, I mean, once you're enrolled in medical assistance, you never need to reapply? Is that typically what happens, or is it just...
Senator Hand, it's here because the language says they're eligible until their 21st birthday, so it'd be up to 3 years.
Until their age 21, I see. Thank you.
Yeah. For foster, the title is for foster children up to age 21. Yep.
Further discussion on Senator Wiergen's amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill? Is there anybody else in the audience who wanted to testify on the bill? If not, Senator Laurie moves Senate File 3146. As amended, be recommended pass, and finance, and this goes to finance as well.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Gloria, you're the second author of Senator Sharon's bill. She's presenting a bill in another committee. Would you like to present it, since I'm sure you know all the details?
I'm hoping it has really good talking points.
But I'm sure it does.
Okay, thank you. Okay. We have Senate File 3581 in front of us. A pharmacy immunization bill. Actually, yeah, I do know this one. This is a good one.
I kind of like this bill, too.
I'm going to be a team player.
So, nearly 90,000 Americans die each year of infections that can be prevented by vaccination, such as influenza, pneumococcal disease, and hepatitis B. In Minnesota, vaccination rates are declining in certain patient populations, and the state is falling short of its goals for vaccine administration. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices continually updates vaccination recommendations and has recently added 3 vaccines for adults. They have also recommended universal vaccination of all children, 0 to 18. And in 2003, pharmacists were given the authority to administer influenza and pneumococcal vaccines to adults age 18 and older. Senate File 3581 simply seeks to amend the pharmacist's scope of practice in 3 ways. The bill would first allow for the administration of influenza vaccines to eligible individuals 10 years and older, changing it from the current 18. It would also allow for the administration of all other vaccines to individuals 18 years of age and older. And lastly, the bill removes the case-by-case restrictions on collaborative practice agreements. And we have
Julie Jensen
here to give any further testimony and to answer questions about the bill.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Laurie did an excellent job of describing our bill. I would only add that we spent a good deal of time talking with our medical, nursing, and public health colleagues to come to agreement on the bill.
Is there anybody, Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair and Senator Laurie, maybe this is for your testifier. On line 1.17, we are changing the age from 18 to 10, and I'm not familiar with the whys and wherefores of the influenza vaccine, but is that does public health support that? Does the medical community support that?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Senator Lynch, both of those communities support that. Actually, the flu guidelines are even less than that, but the community supports 10 and above for pharmacist involvement at this time.
And the community in this case is doctors or?
Senator Marty, doctors, nurses, public health, and the Board of Pharmacy.
Is there anybody in the audience who wanted to speak to this bill? Is there any further discussion from members of the committee? Senator Hand.
I'm just curious about the deletion on the case-by-case basis. What is the rationale for that? It seems like what we're saying is that the pharmacist has the authority to do these things with some cooperation with the supervision physicians or program. What is the take off the case-by-case basis, what does that mean? Does that mean that you not need to have a specific permission on a specific case to administer the program? And doesn't that sort of remove the oversight from the physician administering the medicines?
Senator Hahn, Mr. Chair, the removal of the case-by-case, in 2003, statute was changed to allow pharmacists to enter into collaborative agreements with physician oversight. At that time, the case-by-case, those 3 words were added to ensure oversight and to ensure that a document had a specific patient name on it. The documents would always have a physician and a pharmacist name. Pharmacists who have worked with these agreements since 2003 actually came to us and said that the physicians would like us to take the case-by-case out as it adds an administrative burden. And they have oversight in all of the collaborative practice agreements anyway.
Further discussion, Senator Dow.
Just one question of is on that collaborative agreement, if for some reason someone takes a vaccine and they have a serious reaction to that vaccine, who's the person liable for, you know, any damages or anything that might occur for it? Is it the doctor? Is it the pharmacist?
Senator Dahl, I'm not sure if you're asking about collaborative practice or the vaccinations. They're two separate initiatives. Vaccinations are always under protocol or standing order. And to answer your question about liability, the liability is shared. It is between both the practitioners.
Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 3581. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Lori. So, Senator Lori, would this be seen as a bill that would fit into that whole cost containment healthcare reform initiative and how we can streamline things and make things more patient-centered and easily accessible?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. Operating at the top of their license, getting each profession to work at the top level that they're able to safely provide patient care is a critical piece of healthcare homes and of a lot of our payment reform efforts. So this does fit nicely.
Okay. On that, Senator Lori moves Senate File 3581 as no amendment. Be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Torres-Ray, I understand you wanted to say something before we adjourn.
Yes.
Go ahead. You've got the floor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I understand that we have some serious concerns about schedules because we're having too many bills, and it seems to me that particularly in this committee and in education, we don't get people to call us ahead of time and tell us that they're going to testify, and then we end up with four or five more people that we were supposed to hear. And obviously this is an open process and this is a democracy, but many of us are not going to be able to have an opportunity perhaps to have our hearings because we're giving that opportunity to people to testify, people who did not call ahead of time to let us know that they wanted to come. And I just wanted to express some concern about that because that is happening right now, that we have people coming at the last minute intending to testify, but they did not call us. And the second thing is that I hear, you know, many of us are asking questions again and again about something, and we know that we are not supporting that piece of legislation, but we continue to put the testifiers through the process of answering questions that are not going to change our point of view. But, you know, in some of the bills that are supposed to move in about half an hour, 20 minutes, we're spending an hour and a half. And I'm just concerned that we're not going to give many members the opportunity to present their bills because we're spending a lot of time in some of the bills. And I'm just questioning, in a way, the fairness of the process for us, or at least kind of have a sense of how do we address that in this committee? And education is not your problem, but I do think that we need to give opportunities to all members to have their bills heard, but we're not going to be able to because we're running out of time.
Senator Coring.
Mr. Chairman, I would just say that we all want things to move quickly, but the legislature does not move quickly. I would bring up the fact that I had a bill that I had heard in 2003, and it took 5 years to get it done. But you know what? I'm okay with that. That's the way the process works. This is a short session, and if you look at the amount of bills, people must bring bills over to my office to give it a bipartisan flavor to have me sign on to it, because I'm getting them, you know, three and four and five every day. And, you know, so we're not going to be able to go through every single bill, but I think that it is important that we hear from people that come here to testify. It is so important they come here. This is the people's house. It's very open. I think that's important. And I think another thing, too, and I'm going to say this again, and I said this to the majority leader, is we seem to have a lot of people that come before the members, with all due respect to the members that come before the meeting, the committee, and say, well, let's just move it out of here and move it to the next committee. That isn't the way things work. This is the policy committee. We're deciding if this is good public policy, and if we need to clean it up, we need to do it here. So, you know, I know some bills aren't going to get heard, and I feel bad about that, but that's, you know, there's always next year. So we just do the best we can. And I will say to Senator Marty, kudos to Senator Marty for, you know, I don't particularly like having meetings at night. I'm tired, you know, but we've heard, this has been a marathon of the bills that we have heard. I mean, this is incredible, you know. So anyway, yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I want to make one comment, then take your comments on that. Thank you, Paul. I do think it's important. It is helpful if people call ahead when they're going to testify. Obviously, some people just find out about the bill shortly beforehand, and people who aren't around here regularly often don't know the process and so on. But I do think it's important that we, one, try and move as efficiently as we can, which is why I try and talk real fast sometimes when we're just doing routine matters like adopting formal authors' amendments and so on. But I also think it is very important we make sure people be heard when they need to be heard. And Senator Coring, I had one bill that passed last year after 21 years.
See, I told you it
takes a long time.
Tobacco
industry fought it year after year after year, and it finally passed last year. But I don't like waiting that long either. Senator Oregon, Senator Dow.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have one I'm hoping to get passed this year in my sixth year here. So, but the other thing is, Senator Torres-Ray, some of our constituents drive here from 2 to 3 hours away, and if they don't know about the bill much ahead of time, or they feel compelled that day to come and testify for some reason, I would never want them to be isolated from the process of their legislature, because this is their legislature, not ours. And the other thing is, the majority set the first deadline so early. We haven't had much time, and you know what? Senator Hahn and I and Senator Coring were not contacted and asked about that. Which, I don't mean that to be crude. It just simply is a fact that we don't like these really early deadlines either, but we had no part in setting them.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, isn't that the first deadline so early? It's that we started so late.
Well, yeah, that too.
Senator Dow.
Well, I guess I wanted to say that, and I'll stay as long as we need to. I mean, sometimes my eyelids, I need to prop them open a little bit. But I think what I found is, rest assured, if we get to a point where things are starting to really bog down, Senator Coring will step forward and say, we need to move this bill.
We count on
it. He and Senator Torres-Ray have both been doing that sometimes. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make a comment, too, because I appreciate Marty, that you have been very tolerant of some of us when we disagree with particular bills, that you allow us to talk about them. And Senator Torres-Ray, I think you're right, that we know that we're not going to convince everybody, although there have been some committees in some instances where you get surprised a little bit and things may change. But I think it is important to do that for no other reason than that some of us who are in the minority or have different views, we want to make sure that there's a record of those views. And so I would hesitate to say, well, let's diminish or do away with the debate, knowing that it's not going to change anybody's mind, so we can just get these things passed through. I think that does do some harm to the process. If you're interested in saying, do we ever want to go back and look at intent or look at what the debates were or understand what the process was, or I think it helps inform the public when we have this experience, even though we're not going to convince each other, maybe. And I hope that those of us who object on occasion, that we don't misuse that time. I try to restrain myself, and I hope all of us do. We don't want to belabor things, but I do think one thing is important.
Well, I think this is good for us to talk about from time to time, even if it is 8:30 in the evening. But I think it is helpful so we all keep sensitive both to the need to move things and also the need to give each other a full chance to talk. And with that, I will announce that we have, I think you all know we are going to have hearings Wednesday, 12:30, and at 6, but we do not expect to have one Friday this week. So if we, Senator Coring, we could have one if you really want to.
No.
With that, this meeting is adjourned.
Yay.
Thank you all.